I'm Ephraim Becker, and my thing, everybody's got their thing, my thing, that's very sweet, thank you very much, is the process by which we go from being immature to mature. That's my thing, studying how it is that we mature from a Torah perspective. So we live, unfortunately, in a society that doesn't have a lot to say about how we mature, which is quite surprising, because any book that is written about any aspect of maturation immediately sells a million copies. Who Moved My Cheese, or whatever it is, that, or Seven Habits, or anything at all that talks about any aspect of maturation sells millions of copies, and that we have nothing to say about it. It's remarkable how little there is about what actually is the maturation process. We talk about effectiveness and not about maturation. This is a remarkable, almost a lack in the Western world. We talk about effectiveness, efficiency, talk about high function, success, but almost nothing about maturation. Let me give you some examples of what's glaring. Imagine for a moment that we have two people, and let me just give you the end of the story so that when I give my story, you're already at the end of the story. The end of the story is that maturation from a Torah perspective, one of the aspects of maturation, is going from predictable to appropriate. So you want to be on a continuum, going from predictable to appropriate. I'm already seeing some nods that it might make some sense. Predictable means that was my nature. Appropriate means I can actually look at the situation. For that, I have to stretch my nature. Because if I don't stretch my nature, then I will always respond predictably. Do we need an example for that? Should we just give them nods and shakes? Is that an example will help?
Yeah.
So we have two people. We're going to call them Reuven and Shimon. That's always, they're always Reuven and Shimon. That's it, always. So, and Reuven is generous to a fault. He's three standard deviations out there at generous. Money runs through his fingers like water. Reuven is the epitome of generosity. Shimon is three standard deviations out there the other way. Nothing. Mine is mine. Two people are in need. One is genuinely needy. Orphaned Kala, a bride, needs to get started in life, genuinely needs some help getting started. Another is a dear relative of these fellows, but he's just a bitter guy. He's a bitter guy, and he feels that somebody wronged him, and he's going to start a smear campaign, and he needs money to run the campaign. He's a bitter guy, and he's going to start stewing up all sorts of trouble. Two of them approach each of these friends of ours, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven gives them both money, so Reuven gets 50% on his score. He got it right, 50%. He helped out this young bride to get started in life, and he did it generously, he did it open-handedly, it was wonderful. But he also helped out this fellow to run his smear campaign. Then the two of them went to Shimon. Well, you know what happened there. Come on, there's social welfare agencies, I don't care about your fight, and I don't care about this. And, you know. He said no to both of them. So he got it right 50%. In order for them to move from predictable to appropriate, and here's the trick, they each have to incorporate into their personality the other extreme, which means that Reuven's going to have to become also a tightwad. And Shimon's going to have to become also an extremely generous person. Because if you don't have the extremes, you are not assured of appropriate. Because some situations require the extreme. If you have the extremes, if you've incorporated the extremes, then you have a broad range, and now it's a question of assessing the situation, assessing the needs, and they can start being appropriate. So this is one simple example of where it is, like, go find the book that talks about maturation as being a process from predictable to appropriate. How could that be? How could we miss that? And that is a fundamental that is set forth in the Rambam. It is explained in the way that I just explained it by Reb Chaim Friedlander in his introduction to the Sifsei Chaim about personal attributes, about midos. And it should be ABCs of a curriculum about maturation. And yet, predictable to appropriate. And that's going to have our range in everything. Because if I think that the reason why I'm putting up a fuss, because my wife did such and such and I'm really putting up a fuss, I've conned myself into thinking that I'm doing that because that's the appropriate response. Con man, do yourself one favor. Con everybody else. Don't con yourself. You didn't respond that way because you thought that was appropriate. You responded that way because it's the only thing you've got in your black bag. And if it's the only thing you've got in your black bag, you keep on responding that way. And anybody who's observing you from the outside would play like a fiddle. Come on, it's the same story again. When couples come into my office, I ask them, they're all set to give the charge sheets, you know, everybody's got their charge sheets. So I said, look, you know what? My experience has shown me that it's always a repetitious story. The details change, but the story's the same, because you haven't yet matured to the point where you're appropriate. So do me a favor. I've been around the block a few times. I've heard all the stories. Just tell me the story that keeps on repeating itself. It's one story. It keeps on repeating because you guys are terribly predictable. Just tell me the one predictable story and you spare me all the details. Because I know that the story replays in 1,000 different ways. And how do I know that? Because they have not. It's just very clear from the nature of the interaction that they've not yet begun the road of maturation. They're stuck in little kidhood. And this is the ABCs. This is the olive bays of becoming a mature person, is noticing the predictable and stretching my range. And it's laughable for people to think, I decided this. How many times have I heard agnostics tell me, you know, Rabbi, I'd love to believe in God. It'd make my life so much easier. But what can I do? You know, I can't believe. Do me a favor. Whether you believe or don't believe, that's none of my business. Don't con yourself into thinking that you have a full range of options in front of you. Believing involves responsibility. You're a person who has shirked responsibility. You are a lifetime volunteer. You're a great volunteer. It's wonderful to see you as a volunteer. Everybody wants you on their team because you're a great volunteer, but you are a person who has no mature relationship with authority whatsoever. So don't do it to yourself. You are predictable. You are welcome. Well, you disbelieve all you want, but you should know that there is another aspect of maturation, and now that I've just introduced another aspect of maturation, which is an effective, healthy relationship with authority that doesn't look like a little child, you know, doing things with his parent, because that's what most of the relationships with authorities look like. They just never outgrew that. I mean, they made a whole church that's basically just childish. A whole childish relationship with God. He's really scary, so I have to make somebody friendly, get in between, help me out. Come on, grow up. Get past it. You know, that's great when you're a little kid, that works. Grow up. So each time the person looks at it, they say, okay, healthy relationship with authority. What would a mature relationship with authority look like? To me, I don't even care what answer you come up with. There's Torah answers, and we need to study those Torah answers. But those are less critical to me than asking the question. So far, questions, comments, reactions, alternative speeches. Let's just get a little bit of feedback so that I can check or check your pulse, see if you're still here. Just give me a little bit of feedback so that I can know where to go. Because I can talk about this for many, many days. Yes, you just stop checking your watch. You just check your calendar.
Rob, I just want to make sure I understand the fundamental of what you're saying.
Excellent. Please.
Act. Started. We act. We're actors on the stage.
Okay.
And the goal is to learn how to act depending on the script we're given.
Give that to me again.
We're actors on the stage and we're just reading the script. Versus
that's childish.
Versus
that's right.
We're given the script and then we have to figure out, okay, how are we going to act with the script we're given?
And that's why you can never role play life. You can never role play life. You can strategize. If you're a good businessman, you can strategize. But everyone knows you can't role play. Because in the end of the day, it's me and you and now. And that moment will never happen again. It has a uniqueness to it. And so all of the parts are set in place until the rubber hits the road. And it's actually me and you now. And that's why endless parenting classes and paint-by-number parenting. When your kid does this, do this. When your kid does this, do this. And you see, I'm really the only effective parent in the world, and you guys are, you know, just losers. So you should have really never had kids. They should have all been mine. But you see, I have an effective way of responding to that problem. And that is to make you all clones of me. And if you just remember everything that I tell you about parenting your kids, then your kids will have me for their parent. And that would be much better than having you for their parent. And if you can buy that, since everybody's a little insecure, so, and you seem like you know what you're talking about, so I'll buy that. So just tell me, what do I do when they do this, and what do I do when they do that? And like, oh no, I went home and they did something else. I got to go to crisis. No, I don't care if it's 2 o'clock in the morning. She's got to wake up. I need to ask her, what do you do when...
Bye, Michael.
And say, wait a second. But the Almighty put these children into my home, not into your home. Somehow, they are meant to encounter my maturation process, not yours. That's the reason why they weren't put into your house, they were put into my house. I need to learn how to be an adult. And to be an adult means I will be unique. I'm not going to be a clone of anybody else. In the end of the day, as I mature, my genuine, authentic uniqueness will emerge. In fact, if you want to be very real about it, the more immature we are, the more similar we are to each other.
Can I try and paraphrase in what you're saying to see if I'm understanding it?
Please do.
Is it fair to say, let's say that there's...
My mind better, huh?
In your... Definitely. She didn't come in the Torah, no?
Come on, be more mature.
In your example, Reuven and Shimon, it's fair to say that there's, or just people in general, that there's two fundamental issues we're dealing with here. One being this sort of an autopilot decision-making process, meaning I just respond instinctively or predictably. And the second being that decision process is based on a set of criteria that I'm using. Part of the maturation is one, getting to an awareness about that I need to move from autopilot into being aware as to how I make decisions. And the second component of that being aware that I need to adjust the criteria that I'm using in making that decision.
I actually want people to be on autopilot.
So just adjust your criteria we're using?
Stretch here. Stretch. This is not about getting the right answer on the test. This is about having as broad a range as a person as I can develop over the span of my lifetime, so that my reactions, my instant, visceral, in the moment reactions, are more closely attuned to what I've studied, to what I've come to understand, to the stretch. When what do you think the trainer tells the runner before he runs the race? Now they've gone into the gym and they've run very, very carefully, and he's observed his ankles and he says, got to get those ankles up a little bit higher. And he's observed the angle of his back, and he says, no, you've got to adjust the angle of your back. And they put weights on him, and there's lots and lots of weights and squats and there's deadlifts and there's all sorts of stuff to prepare him for the race. What do you think the trainer tells him when he's about to run the race? Does he say, you know, don't forget about those ankles, and don't forget, don't forget about the... What does he tell him? There's a black and white flag down there. Go get them! Right? That's what he tells him. So we're always looking to use training process. There's a maturation training process where we are doing slow motion, analyzing, reviewing, tuning, fine-tuning, understanding the Torah sources, making as deep an impression as we possibly can, and then run the race.
Right.
So we're always doing the two things, we're alternating to the two things.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the ultimate getting to that point.
It's always happening. It's not ultimate. It's always happening. In other words, after this conversation today, unless you were fast asleep, there will be some difference in the way that you viscerally respond. Not because you are playing out the script of this meeting, but because this meeting has left some sort of imprint, and to the extent that you apply yourself to this meeting, that imprint will be greater.
So it's not necessary to understand, the four quadrants of learning, just knowing that I don't know.
Often that's enough. Again, there's a continuous process whereby we refine and hone and get more awareness. So that we wouldn't narrow it down, just like we wouldn't narrow the person down at the gym.
Mm-hmm.
The person, when he starts, he can barely lift up his ankles to his toe.
Mm-hmm.
Can't. That's it. Bad back, neglect. But having done that, there's an imprint, and the way that he walks when he leaves the gym is a little different. He's still creeping along with his cane, though. Okay. You know what? The rabbis tell us that there is a contrast between golem and chacham. Golem is not supposed to bring up Frankenstein-like images in your mind, believe it or not. Golem is from the Hebrew word chomer gelem. It means raw material. We're always on a road between raw material and chacham, and wise. And that road is an infinite road. And so the rabbis give us some signposts. They say, if you find yourself interrupting somebody, or if you find yourself having an urgency to respond, if you find yourself, there's a 7 criteria that are given there in the Mishnah. If you find yourself there, don't get down on yourself. Recognize that you're still raw material. They're giving you some signposts. So there's people who take that mission and say, okay, from here on out, I'm not going to interrupt anybody. That's it, man. I've done. I hear it. I don't want to be... Wait a second. Don't act like a wise person, although that might be good if you want to train yourself in a healthy way, but you're never going to be able to get to wisdom if you just script out wise people.
Mm-hmm.
Scripting wise people won't make you wise. It'll make you a bit of a mimic, to say nothing of the fact it'll make you inauthentic. And there's nothing worse than the person who's got his scripts well worked out, and then in the background of his heart, he's just all over the place. It means the rabbis are saying, oh, here's some signposts that will tell you where you are. Oh, that's important to know. Thank you. And there's lots, and there's other signposts that will help you know whether you're in the direction of chacham. Thank you. Because it's a little hard to navigate this without signposts. So signposts tell me that I'm still in Chicago on my way to New York. I don't know why anybody would make that trip, but assume for a moment that... So the signposts are necessary, and we're grateful for the signposts. But if it says that the signpost says that there's still 900 miles to New York, I would be a fool to make believe I'm already there. The signposts are exactly that. Useful signposts. There's nothing bad about clay. Clay is not bad. Clay is raw. The pottery, that's where we're looking to go. Will I necessarily get to the point where I'm going to make the piece of pottery that's going to sit on the queen's table? I don't know. I don't know. But I need the signposts, and I need to know the vector, and I need to know where we're going. We're going from raw material to mature. The word that the rabbis use for mature is chacham. And that's why the great sages, people didn't know who they were. They were completely hidden. Because somebody came to them and needed an encouraging word, and they were supportive and nurturing and helped find the person's sense of comfort and gave that to them. And a student, where they felt they could mold that student into the next generation's leader, they sat on their head and just broke their head. They wouldn't give them an inch. And if they asked a question that wasn't 100% exact, they would shoot the question back at them and make them reframe the question. And then another one who, when he heard of a tragedy, was crying, and he fell apart and melted into his tears. And it came to Purim, and it was a character. So the four people are sitting there and all talking about the same great sage, and they say, I know him. He's a character. You should see him at Purim. Man, he was amazing. Character. Character. He's a heavy man. He's with no character there. Are you kidding? Character? He's not a hoe. Anything but a character. No, he's just all heart. That's all he is. He's just, you should see him. I'm telling him, you know, my wife, when we had that terrible loss, I'm just sitting there crying. He's just all heart. That's all he is. Just, and the other one says, all heart. He's like an arrow. I was on the brunt end of his, and, well, they must not be talking about the same person. And the answer is, yes, they are. They're talking about Chacham, who does not get docketed into such a narrow range because he spent his whole life expanding his range. And as such, it's not plastic reactions. Those are not plastic, I think I should sound a little bit sympathetic today. Those are him, and he embodies this enormous range, and that's why you can't know them unless you spend a tremendous amount of time with them. You can't know them. And that is the key. One of the keys of maturation is that those who are less mature will not understand you. If those who are less mature understand you completely, you're probably not that mature. If your child understands every one of your decisions, you're probably not a parent. And I often see parents, usually young parents, doing this. Well, don't you understand? You've got school tomorrow morning, and that's why you can't stay up with the cousins who are in the... And the kid goes, but I want to stay up. And I was like, oh, sit there scratching my head. Dad, why are you explaining this to him? What's the deal? Look how many things are going into this explanation. You are trying to get him to be out of his range because he can't understand, because he just wants to stay up. Which is perfectly understandable, actually. He's a kid, and those are cousins. I mean, what about this is hard for you? Second, why can't you make an executive decision? Third, why does he have to agree with you? Fourth, do you not believe that you can be compassionate when you exercise executive control? Is that why you need him to sign on? Because you're otherwise going to turn into a barracuda? Hey, this is time to stretch your range a little bit. Stretch. That's a mature decision. Make the decision. Doesn't matter if you're wrong. Make the judgment call. It has to be. And stretch. This is a stretch on many fronts of maturity. It's a relationship with authority. It's a relationship with with mandates. It has to do with the relationship of compassion with a child. It has to do with a lot of things. Why does the kid have to be involved? Why does he have to sign on and say, okay, now you're the dad? What? And the answer is, because frankly, I thought I could have kids without growing up. And he's really a pain in the neck because he's making me grow up, and I don't want to do that because that means taking responsibility for these decisions, and I don't even take responsibility for my own life, so I'm certainly not going to take responsibility for his life. So would he please raise himself? And the last thing I want to do is be responsible for him, because you know, you start getting responsible, you never know where it stops. You could end up being responsible for like lots of things. I learned long ago, you know, don't pick up a mop in your house. Just don't pick up a mop. You never know where it stops. You pick up a mop, you don't know where it's going to go. You could end up taking out the garbage. I mean, just think about it, man. Don't go picking up the mop. Your wife's not feeling well, but call somebody else in. Don't pick up a mop. You don't know. Responsibility is very dangerous. And that is, so again, there's this discussion about the maturation process, which is not about effectiveness, efficiency, productivity, function. It's about becoming more mature. And ultimately, becoming more mature is becoming more godlike. I know that sounds like a little bit of a leap, but if you think about it a little bit philosophically, there is absolutely no limit to Hashem's range of options. And therefore, if there's no limit to range of options, then every decision is absolutely appropriate. Does that intuitively make sense? And what happens is that when we're childlike, we assume, oh, God's angry at me. Oh, he just doesn't want to give me that because he's mean. Or, oh, he's such a nice guy. You know, look what he did. Whoa. It's a little more mature than that. Just try to stretch yourself a little bit, and believe it or not, you'll encounter him in a more mature place. So there's a religious component aside from the fact that a person is becoming more of the person that we were meant to be. There's also the component of becoming more aligned with our Creator. So maturation is not a trivial matter. It's not something that we can leave to the side. It has everything to do with the way that we conduct the business of our lives and the way that we conduct ourselves with our eternal Creator. So this is a subject. That's one of the reasons why I can keep on talking about this indefinitely. Would somebody else stop me? Yeah, go ahead.
So what's the it's like an infinite number of ways to mature, but what are the most effective? Should we read Mesillas Yashim for 5 hours a day, like?
Just come to my classes, listen to everything that I have to say, and don't do anything else other than what I tell you. Right, that's the only way to go. Everything else is basically trivial. That's right. You can buy Rebecca CDs, and then there's the baseball cards. You know, I sign them. If you hang them on the wall, you'll be more mature. You know, especially with a chamsa. You know, a chamsa with my baseball card and my signature. And you're all set. The maturation process starts and finishes with an awareness of a number of factors. The awareness is, am I aware of my strengths and my predictability? Meaning strengths, meaning the areas that I can, that I have something to offer. My predictability, are the ways in which my nature is still kind of raw. My awareness, increased awareness of the situation that I'm confronting, that would be included in the words, there's always more to it. There's always more to it. I have a client, I very rarely stretch to young clients, but there's a 16-year-old girl who comes to the office, and she gets into a fight with her mother about the color of her nail polish. So I said, could you consider the possibility that the fight is not about nail polish? What do you mean? I tried to put on nail polish. She says I can't put on that color nail polish. I got the script. I can almost picture it. But would you believe me if I told you that this interaction is not about nail polish? That both you and your mother are playing out a very profound drama in that room that has nothing to do with nail polish. And it started when you were a little girl and you didn't want to eat your vegetables. What's this got to do with eating vegetables? Well, why don't you step out of your story for a minute and talk about the little kid who doesn't want to eat the vegetables. What do you think he might be saying? He's saying he doesn't like vegetables. Okay, let's stretch that a bit. Perhaps he's asking about where is the locus of control in my life? Am I in charge of my life or is somebody else in charge of my life? And I, as an emerging human being, do I have any control in my life? He's asking about love. He's asking whether or not he can be loved, even if he's naughty. He's asking whether or not there are adults in his world, whether they will discipline him, but not lose sight of the fact that he's still a child. He's asking some very, very fundamental questions. And he got sent off to his room with his harangue about vegetables. And he's sitting there in his room, this little kid, and he says, you know, I just tried to make the most eloquent speech that I could about asking about locus of control and whether I can be loved even if I'm naughty and whether there's discipline and somebody who will guide this ship. And I got back this whole thing about vegetables. Where does that come from? Like, go tell him, well, what do you mean? You only talked about vegetables. Yeah. So they only heard vegetables and I did the best I could. I tried to talk about all of the important things that were going on in my life. And they would have been saved if they would have just had one expression up on the wall. There's always more to it. I don't care. If you want to kill your kid for not eating vegetables, I don't have a problem with that. I don't get involved in anybody's parenting. You decide they got to eat the vegetables. I happen to not decide things like that because I can't stand force-feeding kids. And if you insist on something, there's only one outcome. That's going to happen. If you insist on something with your child, that's what the child's going to do. If I say pajamas, I know what's going to happen next. The child knows what's going to happen next, and that's why they don't put up a fuss. Because when I say pajamas, they give me pajamas. If I have to put the pajamas on them or not. But I will not say, eat the chicken. Because I love feeding babies, by the way. I love. My kids know, bring the grandchildren over. You know, they love. I love feeding. But I will not stuff anything down the throat of a four-year-old. And it's not happening. Or certainly not older. So, it's kind of against my nature. So I will never tell them that they have to do it, because whatever I tell a child that he has to do, that's what's going to happen. I can suggest, I can say, look, I think you should try the chicken. If you don't, you know, there's certainly no dessert if you don't try the chicken. I suggest that you try the chicken. It's your call. But there's the story. Now, what I've done is I've said, look, this is what only part of this that I can control is whether or not you get dessert. You know, you're going to be hungry. This is a nice, you know, here's a good option. But beyond that, if I say something's going to happen, that means that's what's going to happen. Why is that so important, by the way? Why is that so critical? This is an aside. Why is that so critical? Because ultimately, there's an internal voice that the child will get at age 12 or 13 that will say go right or go left. And we bring the child with a tear in our eyes and a prayer on our lips to their own rider, the rider on their own horse. And if we haven't gotten them used to the idea that when the rider, who never screams, by the way, the internal rider never screams, always speaks in a soft, still voice and says, go right. Says, yeah, but there's something really cool on the left. And it all go right. It's like the GPS, you know. Just go right. And if you haven't gotten them used to that, that there's a soft, still voice, that's what just is going to happen. So then when you bring them to their own rider, they will hear the voice, go right. They will be drawn to go left, and they'll go left, and they'll have guilt because they disconnect. And so that's why immature parenting leaves the children with a tremendous amount of guilt, because they're going to get their rider. But I wasn't preparing them to get a rider. When they're little, I'm the rider. No, I don't want to be the rider. I'll explain everything to them. So the idea that the child is getting a clear message, the clear message is that there's more to it. And so when she gets to the point where she's talking about nail polish, they can start seeing that there's more to it than nail polish, because they're already used to that. They're used to the fact that there's a drama that's playing out here that's not just about nail polish. There's a drama that's going on that has to do with emerging autonomy, and has to do with compliance with norms, and has to do with being loved even if they're naughty. It's kind of the adult version, or the older version of the asparagus. Was there a question that I was trying to work on?
Yeah.
How do we mature? Tools, how do we mature? So did it give you enough food for thought to sort of overload your circuits yet? That's all I've been looking to do. I'm just looking to overload your circuits and leave. If there's anybody left in the room whose circuits are not yet overloaded, I'll stick around. After everybody's circuits are overloaded, I leave. So that's all we're looking to do, is just to so overwhelm you with this that there's no way that you could follow somebody's prescription. You're going to have to discover your own.
Or can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Yeah. So, being aware of the situation, you made 2 points around, strengths and predictability, and then being aware of the situation. But what happens when you have that lapse in awareness? So you have the strengths and you know your predictability, but you have that lapse in awareness and you find you're stuck. So what are the... I don't want to say what are the tools, because that's asking for predictability. But
I will tell you that you just walked right into the answer. You did it all by yourself. Listen carefully to what you just said, and you will see that there's a certain resistance that you still have to being stuck. And that's where you need to work, to stop being afraid of being stuck. The rabbis tell us that as we mature, it becomes easier to get stuck. It's a feature of wisdom. It makes it easier to get stuck to the I don't know, to the huh. And when we're childlike, we need everything answered. We need to dot all the I's and cross all the T's and get it all worked out. And one of the features of maturation is, that is interesting. I don't know. I don't know how to play this moment. And being stuck and being good with being stuck, knowing that much of the real juice of our growth comes out of being stuck, is one of the marks of somebody who's on a road towards wisdom. People who need instant answers say, the golden, the Mishnah could have listed a few other things. I need the answer now. Why do you need the answer now?
What are the risks of going through this process in front of children? I mean, maybe ultimately you mature before you have children, but if you're going through this in front of your children and you're not predictable, And you don't get it right every time, how does that affect them, and what types of tools can you use to kind of keep them going on the right path as you kind of get it right and get it wrong?
You will have laid the groundwork for them to continue growing throughout their lives. I believe deeply that that's the reason why children were not given to 70-year-olds, because the children would never get a glimpse of what it means to grow.
So they should see that.
Absolutely. They will see it. You don't have to demonstrate it. They will see it. They will sense in that moment of pause. Now, if I pause and then forget that I'm also the father, so then I've paused at their expense. In other words, in the end of the day, if somebody were to say, is it better to make the judgment call and be wrong, or to hesitate to the point where no judgment call is made? Well, in certain circumstances, such as in certain parenting circumstances, my guess is if you're quite sure that you'll review your decision afterwards, I would recommend making the call. Not because it's going to be the right call, but because kids need that. Make the call. Now, if it's a very high stakes decision, don't make the call. So what's the high stakes decision? You will sense whether it is or is not a high-stakes decision. Whether we're going to go out tonight or stay in tonight is a low-stakes decision. I make the call. Yeah, but this one says, and it... Make the call. If you want to afterwards review, did I say we're not going out because I'm cheap? did I say we're not going out because I wanted to spite my wife because she didn't make dinner last night? Did I say we're not going out, or did I say we're not going out because we've been out three times this week? And I think that there was a judgment call that's excessive, and that we've become addicted to junk food. And so we stayed in, and we all, you know, made some baked potatoes, and we had a good time. Opened the can of tuna fish, and we had a good time. So I don't have no problem with that judgment call is sometimes inevitable. And it's the key is that what I'm presenting to them is not the same as what is happening internally, because what's happening internally is very private. Internally, I am broken, trying to get it right, trying to understand the moment, trying to understand my own strengths, trying to understand what Hashem wants from me in this moment. What happens externally is pajamas, now. And that, one of the features of maturity, is to have a bigger and bigger disconnect between the transcendent self that is operating internally and the appropriate self that is interfacing with the world. A leader, for example, has to be firm. People can't deal with it otherwise. It happens to be an anxiety-provoking experience for anyone being led to feel that there's a waffly leader. But that doesn't mean that they have to. I don't have to buy my own PR. Internally, like, review, calculation, thought.
So you, when you go back to what you said before about Shimon and Reuven, you need to work on your Shimon and Reuven in order to be able to get to the appropriate response.
Which may be anywhere on the range.
Right. Do you need to also look at your children then and try and broaden their Shimon and Reuven as well, or do you let them find their own Shimon and Reuven? Is that
good question. Good question. My experience has been that their expanding range is a function of your working to expand your range. You don't have to expand theirs. They'll get the appropriate from your expanding range, and they will sense that could have only come from somebody who had an expanding range. When you act unpredictably, meaning appropriately, they will sense, hey, wait a second, he's either drunk or there's something else going on that we're not getting. And when they conclude he doesn't seem drunk, they will start asking. And those questions are the most precious possible questions. Would you explain why you did this rather than that? When the children don't ask questions, it's because parents are utterly predictable. There's nothing to ask. So their range will be expanded as they interface with your ever-expanding range. With that said, as the children get older, there's going to be a natural expansion of their range because of the tasks and what you call on them to do. I, for example, have had a rule when my kids were growing up. I had a rule that I'd learned. Somebody gave me this rule. It was just such a gift. He said, if you really want your kids not to be so focused on winning, make sure that when you play with them, you never, ever win. That's a tip. So I remember when my kids were learning how to play chess, and one of them said, Abba, this time, play for real. So I said, you sure you want that? He said, yeah. I had my doubts that he was ready for that. Question mark. So I had it down to pretty full board, and he was left with a king. So I said, there's a rule that only Abbas can do. Only Abbas. As I'm looking at him, I'm seeing that he's turning colors. I said, there's a rule here that only Abbas can do. Nobody else can do it. And just at a special moment like this, we turn the board around. and he turned the board around, and he finished the game, and he won. And as he was going to sleep, he turned to my wife, and he said, "Abba did something tonight that you can't do in chess, but he wanted me to win." So as they got older, I was able to say to them, "Wait a second, the younger one always wins. I don't care what you have to do. I don't care how you have to cheat. I don't care what's involved. But the younger one always is going to win. I don't want to hear you, you know, beating him. The younger one wins." And they knew exactly what I meant. And they developed very, very clever strategies for helping the little ones win. So is that a stretching of their range? So I am, in a sense, stretching their range. But again, it's a stretching the range because it's like, that's what we do here. What we do here is that the younger one wins. And that becomes part of the game. Part of the game is cleverly coming up with strategies for how to get the younger one to win. All I'm really doing is just flipping the game around on them because they're showing off to me how they won, meaning how they figured out how to play the game and get the little one to win. So you didn't really stretch their range in the fullest sense. They're not really giving up anything. They're still showing off that they won, except that we've turned the tables on it a little bit, and that's useful for later on. So what we're doing is with children, we're acclimating them to the behaviors that they will need when they start making actual choices. So right now it's just a training, a behavioral training for the behaviors that they will need when they start making choices, when they get their own rider. So I didn't really believe, just like parents who say to their kids, "Hey kid, what are you saying? Thank you." Is the kid feeling gratitude? That's not philosophy. Fooling yourself is only for the firstborn. Yeah. Oh, my firstborn, you know. Are you kidding? Gratitude? Firstborn is already a saint. So they're not yet feeling gratitude. Gratitude means nothing was due me. It was not owed to me. I'm not entitled. I am therefore grateful because you have given me, and not a sense of entitlement. Children have an absolute sense of entitlement, and so teaching them to say thank you does not reduce their sense of entitlement. Only a mature person can reduce his sense of entitlement. However, if you don't give the child the behavior called thank you, then at such point as he starts feeling the sense of deference, he has no behaviors to fall back on. So you kind of set him back by not giving him the behavior. Unfortunately, parents don't work on their own gratitude. They're still walking around looking terribly childlike in their sense of entitlement. The child now has the behavior called thank you, which has been associated with getting the candy. It's really sad. I don't know why parents do that. You know, until the kid says please, he doesn't get the candy. What? And if he does say please, he always gets the candy? What kind of business is that? You can't make an executive decision. The kid has to say please because he has to say please. You give him the candy whether or not you decided to give him a candy. When a kid says please, I give him a kiss. I'm so happy you said please, but no candy now. What's this business? If you say please, you get candy. That's it. That's how they learn the sense of entitlement. Well, I said please, so I'm entitled to get everything in the world. They go through life like that. I said please. Therefore, you're no longer a sentient human being because I said please. Therefore, you're beholden to me. You owe me. I said please. What? Somebody's got to get a refund on their tuition. I mean, where? What happened? So these are just, again, we can sit and talk about individual examples, and some of them are clever and some of them are less so. It doesn't matter. In the end of the day, it's just getting the wheels turning to say, so there's a thing called going from immature to mature, and it's not just about higher function. It's not just about becoming a better businessman. Questions? Yeah?
If you don't mind going back to the chess example.
I'm delighted.
It's kind of a joke in a way is that Canadians seem to be very happy with mediocrity.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a whole lot of conversation going on whether, you know, every kid gets a trophy at the end of the season, whether they won or not. And I'm just curious as to kind of your thoughts around at what point in a kid's life, should you, could you actually give them that sense that, you know what, you lost. And there are some people that succeed and get reward, and some people that don't succeed and you don't.
Be aware that the only place where we don't teach anything about the real world is in school. So that the child spends about 13 or 14 years of his life getting an unreal world. That's a little bit of a tricky training ground. Let me just explain to you how unreal that is. In the real world, imagine that a company goes bankrupt. But the guy who worked in accounting said, that was because of the guys in production, the guys in sales, they really messed up. But we in accounting, we did a great job, so I'm not giving up my job. I'm staying with my job, staying with the benefits, staying with everything. What would we tell him? Company went bankrupt. If you thought you had something to say to the guys in production and the guys in sales that might help them move forward, you should have said something. No, you can't keep your job. 13 years of, don't you worry about what he does. You do your own thing. Don't you worry about what he does. And then expect them to have anything to do with the real world. It's a shock that any kid comes out of school but is able to function in the real world at all. It's absolutely shocking. No sense of interdependence at all. Just do your own thing. If you do your own thing, you can be absolutely successful just doing your own thing. Wow. So, whenever we're exposing a child to reality, when children are little, they're very good at getting reality. Little children, until they get exposed to this school business, they're actually quite good at reality. They'll test the limits as to whether or not that really is the reality. You know, if you say, oh, you can't go out today, sweetheart. It's raining outside. No, we can go out when it's raining anyway. We can walk between the raindrops. I won't get muddy. We can go to the park. I'm not going to get muddy. Sweetheart, hopefully tomorrow. Today it's raining. Come, that's fine. Find something inside that we can do. So, and they test that a little bit, but they're cool. They stop getting involved with reality when this unreality sets in called school. It's just an unreal, surreal world where they have nothing, there's no actual interaction, there's nothing that resembles real world in school. And so then we start with this tricky process of reintroducing them to real world. There's successes, there's failures, there's things we do better, there's things we do worse. So I think the best answer that I can give you is, if a parent does not think themselves in school terms, they'll be fine in helping the child adjust to the real world. Meaning, if the child comes home and does poorly in math, and the parent says, oh, I guess we need to spend some more time practicing math, as opposed to, oh no, I thought we were perfect. What are we going to do now? I didn't sign on for an imperfect kid. You know how many years I waited to have you? You have to be perfect. What's going to happen? What am I going to tell my in-laws? Yeah. Like, so the parent who sees the child's challenges in very natural ways, in other words, not in school terms, will naturally be bringing the child into reality. Oh, so math is hard for you? Okay, we'll spend some more time with math, see what we can do with it. It's when there's a fatal flaw. It's the association of the fatal flaw. That's why they give every kid a reward. Because they've so bought in that being less than a 10 in anything is a fatal flaw. You may not be less than a 10. We waited 9 years before we had you. We want 10 across the board, you know, like the Jewish mother. For everything that I put in, it's one Nobel Prize so much to have. You know, like, big deal. It's one. I'm not looking for four. One, you know. So that the sense of that it is hard when you wait 9 years for the kid and you're just going to have one and you sort of you put away money for his graduate school and you know he's an artist, you know, he's not heading off to graduate school. You're like, no, this is they switched the kids in the hospital. This is not, I brought home the wrong kid. There's just no way that this is my kid. And instead of, oh, so I'm now meeting somebody other than myself, not a clone of me, and they don't always have to be a 10. That's what we're in the world for. We're in the world to take all of our fours and fives and sixes and move them up as the extent that we can. And so it, as the parent matures, they are able to transmit that in that instant reaction when they hear that the child has difficulty with something. In that instant moment, the child picks up, is that a fatal flaw or is that part of that? Is that part of living? And I can't possibly script that for anybody else. That is essentially where I am. It's just like I would tell a teacher, the most precious moment in teaching, the most precious moment is when a child asks a question. The rabbis tell us that there's two things that are the critical components of learning, asking questions and making mistakes. Those are the only two critical aspects of learning. If you don't do those two things, no learning is happening. Got to ask questions and you got to make mistakes. So here, there's the moment. The kid asks his first question. I tell the teachers, I can't prepare you for that moment. But I can tell you that it's going to come at the worst possible moment. It's going to come in the middle of Chumash class. And a kid has been sitting there sassy, you know, with his arms folded, sitting back saying, oh, he's got nothing to teach me here. You know, for the last 5-6 years. But he senses that in your class, maybe there's some room to ask a question, to expose the fact that there's something that he doesn't know. And in the middle of Chumash, he goes, that bulb was lit yesterday. Rabbi, why do bulbs blow out? Right in the middle of Chumash class.
Come on.
Does it meet the basic criteria for a question? You know what the basic criteria for a question is? I don't know, and I would like to know. That's the basic criteria. That's why, who put their briefcase in the middle? That's not a question. It does not meet, why do I need to go to bed? My brother doesn't need to go. That does not meet the criteria for questions. I never answer a non-question. But here's a question. It may not be appropriate person, place, time, you know, I may miss some of the trappings. But on the basic level, I don't know, and I would like to know. Now, you're in the middle of teaching Chumash. But there's a precious moment where if he doesn't get a sense that what just happened is life-altering and could lead him to become a Torah scholar. What? Light bulbs? In the middle of Chumash? It may be years and years and years before anybody hears from him again. He'll just give answers. Just like teachers. You know, a sassy kid. He's got answers for everything. No questions. So the teacher says, so what should I do? I can't tell you what you should do. But if you work on really understanding that the questions are the most critical thing that happened in the class, and that everything else that you're doing is really just feeding and formulating and helping create questions, then you'll respond, well, what would you do? So, you know, I can't role play this, but it has happened to me. And my reaction is, Pasuk Dalet. And I go on, because I will not give up Chumash, especially since I don't know anything about, thank God I don't know anything about light bulbs. The teachers are know things about light bulbs. They're like a total loss. Oh, you asking about light bulbs? All of a sudden, you got 25 kids talking about light bulbs. Chumash is out the window. I mean, the whole thing is the total distortion of priorities. And all we're doing now is talking, well, because after all, he asked the question. But he needs a real sense that something very precious just happened. I can't tell you how to do that moment. I can tell you that if you're predictable, you need to stretch, because that is a precious moment. and it will happen, and it will happen at the worst possible time, because they've got antenna and they know to test whether or not, are you really for real that you welcome questions? Really, really? Let's find out. And so if you start answering the question, you're selling to them that, that Chumash is not important, and that's not a value you want to communicate. So the same thing is true at that moment when the child comes in all upset that he didn't do so well on his test. Everything in that moment is who you are and how you relate to the idea that people are here to grow, as opposed to being a 10 from the time they're born to the time they die. And I can't script that, but I can tell you that if your instant reaction is, oh, but in my mind you got 100 because you really tried and you really studied, so for me you're 100, then you have to ask yourself, huh, so I guess I'm not okay with person being, with my kid being a 7 either, huh? Okay, fine, got it. Work to do, predictable. It's okay, don't kill myself for it, but I need to know that about myself. So that moment is a precious moment, and those moments will happen, and they will happen at the worst possible moment. And they will happen the night before parent-teachers meetings. You know, where oh, I can't believe I'm going to have to talk about this with a teacher. You know, the kid doesn't, whatever. So the answer is, know yourself, try to get to know, am I okay with a growth process, with this maturation process? And is it okay for me, for somebody to be working on something? Do I write it off? If anything needs to be worked on, if at first you don't succeed, quit. Just quit. Don't do it. Don't take on anything you can't do well. Be an American. Don't ever, ever take on something you don't do well. You only take on things you do well. There's a certain college that I happen to be familiar with that have 98% acceptance rate to medical school. Now, no school has a 98% acceptance rate. Harvard doesn't have a 98% acceptance rate to medical school. But they had a very simple strategy. If they saw in your junior year that you weren't going to make it into medical school, they told you they weren't giving you any recommendations. So a little bit of pre-screening. There was no... It was that?
Else you leave.
But they just said, you know, choose a different field. We're not going to give you recommendations to medical school. We have a statistic to defend. So, and that was it. Like, no recommendations. You couldn't go to medical school. That was a remarkable statistic. I wondered how it is that they didn't have, that 2% didn't get in. What kind of morons. If you're already doing that, how did you? Anyway, so everything depends on that moment, and for better or for worse, that moment can never be scripted. It's a product of where have I come to by this point? My older children say to me when they look at me dealing with my little kids, they say, Abba, you're so different with them. So I said, do you think I was standing still for 20 years? They're grandchildren. They don't bug me. I'm totally cool with them, and I'm able to set boundaries. They're grandchildren. Did you think that I was standing still? That would be a very sad testimony if I was still parenting them the way I had parented you, standing on your head. What would the point then be of the interval, of the growth? Yes, of course I deal with them differently. And thank God for that. Questions, comments, reactions, go ahead.
The internet. Any guidelines, thoughts,
perspective
on how to handle it? Yeah. Seems to be such a problem with smartphones and things. Are we overreacting to the severity of it? And the principles we talked about should be sufficient, or do we have to sort of think about handling it differently? Realizing everybody's in a different situation, but
two principles that may be useful for you. One is that you will never be able to eliminate your child's challenges. And the other is you may not expose your child prematurely to challenges. Unfortunately, there are people who approach it forgetting those two principles. They take one, they forget the other. Mm-hmm. One is you will not. I know somebody who didn't praise their child, didn't want them to be a Balgaiva. Good. Never, the child never heard a word of praise. because it was a very gifted, very talented child, and the mother was convinced that the child would have terrible gaiva, be full of himself, and so the child never heard a word of praise. Like a lapdog, asking every adult in the world to give him praise. Became absolutely praise-starved. So there's two sides of the coin. One is you will not be able to eliminate your child's challenges, but you may not be indifferent to the exposure that those premature exposure to those challenges. And the same thing is true with yourself. You cannot eliminate your own challenges, but you may not be arbitrary. There's a famous story in the Gemara. The Gemara says that a student reported to his teacher that he walked along the river and he didn't look at the women who were bathing, who were washing their clothes, who obviously had to take off some of their clothes or raise their clothes in order to do the wash with the washboards in the river. And he said, I went by and I didn't look. And the teacher called him a Rasha. Why didn't you walk the other way? Why did you have to walk there? Why did you test yourself? Why didn't you walk the other way? So there's competing guiding principles. We're not going to, if you go at it with a sense of, I am going to eliminate all challenges from my child. My child's going to be a 10, including in their religious life. They're going to be a 10, and I'm going to guarantee it. You will not guarantee that they will be a 10, because they will have to struggle with conscience. However, if you are indifferent to the exposures, if you are indifferent to them, then you are sending effectively the message that I am not the rider, I am not your rider. And that is a job that I do have. I am the rider. And therefore those decisions absolutely have to be made. So I can't give you the specifics, because obviously each person is unique, but I think that the guiding principles are the mature principles of recognizing what it means to be a parent and what it means ultimately to recognize and to be an ally to the child as the child matures and has to deal with their challenges. I want the child to see how I deal with challenges. Yeah.
I know you said 12 and 13, but what age do you actually stop being the rider with your children?
In America or anywhere else?
Anywhere else.
I don't know. In America, our parents are still doing this when the kid is 40. It's a progression. It's a progression that starts very, very early when you start encountering the child as other. But at 12 and 13, you move into advisory mode. Now, the 12 and the 13-year-old, they're a new driver. And a new driver is a weak driver. It's an inexperienced, weak driver. And so there's more room to be a consultant. And if the relationship is intact, they will turn to the parent more when they're a weak driver. They sense that they're a driver, but they'll consult more. Obviously, as they go along, the consultations become fewer, sometimes more meaningful. You know, my 30-year-old, when he consults with me, it's rare, but it's deep. It's not consulting of, you know, what do I do with the fact that Sandy left rats in my basement? He deals with it. You know, thank God I'm not there to deal with it. He deals with it. So that is that's a progression. But again, we have to recognize that at a certain point we move into advisory role, and therefore the time that we are rider, and there can't be two riders on the horse. There cannot be two riders on the horse. There is a point where I have to bring him to his rider. It is around age 12 and 13, and I need to move into advisory role. Yeah.
Just kind of on that, building off what you were just saying, I have an 11-year-old son, and we're relatively new to being on the derech. So how does one react to a child that wants to be his own driver when he's not ready to be a driver?
Why is that? What is the complication associated with that? Help me get me into the place.
It all started when I was child.
Yeah, right. It's not to my grandparents, actually. I have a survivor grandparents, and like, you know, let me just start from the beginning. No, just tell me where the struggle is here.
So I think part of the struggle is...
Well, let me help you with why isn't this simple? You made a judgment call.
Yeah.
And you either gave him the keys to the executive bathroom or you didn't.
I don't want him to make my mistake.
Okay. Brilliant. Brilliant. How in the world can you possibly protect him from that? One nice thing that you now have that perhaps at a certain point you did not have is prayer. And I'll tell you something else that you now have that you may not have had before. The centrality of having a very harmonious relationship with your wife. Those two features give you an edge that you did not have before you were on the derech. Having a good relationship with my wife was essentially a functional issue, a fun issue, or a functional issue. It was not a profoundly meaningful issue, and prayer wasn't really asking for what I really need, and now it's asking for what I actually need. I'm praying for the child. Those two factors, a harmonious relationship at home, and prayer, critical. Everybody's circuits fried?
Yeah.
I'm out of here. Hatzlocha, gentlemen. Wonderful to meet you. Look forward, please God, to carrying on if such an opportunity arises. I'd love to come to some of your home countries if you're ever, if anybody has any inclination to host a madman speaker. I would be very happy to come out there.
Yeah.
I'm going next week for a week of speaking, and I'll be back. I'll go if somebody just waves a little flag in front of me, I'll go.
Rabbi, just one last question.
Yes.
Rabbi Sher mentioned that you host certain IDM on Skype. Or
yes, we are starting a new one starting this coming Tuesday night at 10:30 Israel time, which I'll be on the East Coast. It'll be 3:30 p.m. Eastern time. That is a half hour. We will be doing the Hakdama of the Shev Shmaitza. There is it's a fascinating, fascinating piece of work that I have wanted to go through a whole bunch of times. I've started any number of times, and I know that if I don't have a group to do it with, then it doesn't happen. And so we'll be starting a new series. My Skype address is, you'll find it if you just look up Ephraim Becker, E-P-H-R-A-I-M Becker, but it is Ephraim.D.Becker. My middle name is David. Ephraim.D.Becker is my Skype address. And anybody who wants to join would be more than welcome. There's a vast range of levels, so you don't have to worry about being too much of a beginner. And if you want to join, it's half an hour, 10:30 Israel time, whatever time zones you find yourself in. There's people from all over the world who are joining in. Sometimes it's two or three of us, and sometimes it's 10, and nobody takes attendance. So it's the text has not been translated into English yet. Maybe when we're done, we might translate it. But the text has not yet been translated into English, and so it's a beautiful Hebrew as it happens. But we'll be doing the translation as we go along.
The
class is followed. It's done in English. We learn in English, I guess.
What's the text?
I'm sorry.
Remain the same time.
Much.
Yeah, it's always 10:30 Tuesday night. 10:30 Tuesday night in Israel, wherever I find myself. It's 10:30 Tuesday night in Israel. Okay, all the best. Hatzlocha.
My recording went out.